Okay, John, we have another guest in studio live this morning.
We have indeed. And we're going from a small town land north of my own place, okay, called Capaban. Did you ever hear of it?
Sheehan,
yeah. And he's very sensitive to the townland name.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a long haul from that particular townland of Sheehan, okay? I don't know what it means, Sheehan.
I'm not sure either, John. There's many of these Irish names that go back many
generations.
Or they go back maybe 1,000 years or more.
Years, yeah.
That's the voice that you heard coming in there. That's the voice of a man born and reared in the Sheehan Hills, okay? And there's a fierce connection between this man and his family, okay, with Australia. And this is Olympic year, isn't it?
It is.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we were all highly enthused there about 2 months ago when the Irish, believe it or not, Jim, swimmers pulled gold in the world championship. This is. And I went to my papers because I remembered that there was a young lady whose roots are in Sheehan. The roots, okay? And you can't go any deeper than the roots.
No.
Who had also had been ignored for so long, okay? Gold medal winner for the 100 metres, okay? In the Stockholm
Olympics
of 1912.
Yes.
So there you have Sheehan.
It's the 100 metres freestyle swimming we're talking about.
We did. But before we get to talk about this young lady, we have to make some reference, you know, to the dynamics of the Sheehan area. What was it, Martin?
Martin Mason, who's our guest this morning.
Yeah.
And you're very welcome.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you, John. I'm delighted to be here to talk about Fanny Durick, who was christened Sarah Frances Durick, but always known as Fanny Durick, who was a first cousin of my father. So to me, she is a first cousin once removed. And going back, I have a letter here. As it happened, this is 2024, and I have a letter here that was written in 1924, which is just 100 years ago.
Yes.
From Fanny's mother. Fanny's mother, which was Mary Mason from Sheehan.
Sheehan.
And Mary Mason from Sheehan. Her mother came from Ogunnilough. So when we talk about Sheehan, we cannot talk about Sheehan without talking about Ogunnilough and Maharik and Mount Shannon, because they are all very closely linked with the success in Australia of the Durick's in particular.
So Fanny Durick's mother was a sister of your
grandfather.
Sister of my grandfather. Of Michael Mason's father.
Yes.
Yes.
So her mother was Connors from Ogunnilough. And for listeners that may not know where Ogunnilough is, it is situated between Scariff and Killaloe.
Indeed.
And about halfway there, there's Tinnerana, and on the left-hand side is a ball alley. And then there's two little houses across from the ball alley, but there are actually four cottages there.
Yes.
They're there at the moment.
They're still there at the moment.
They're partially hidden by trees.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I remember there was a sweet shop there in my young days, because Ogunnilough was hometown to me as well when I was young. And there was a sweet shop there, and I remember buying sweets. Yes. I love sweets. I don't know if all youngsters love sweets.
Indeed they do.
I know, you know, older people who love sweets, Martin.
No.
Yes.
So anyhow, Fanny Durick's mother was Mary Connors from Ogunnilough, and married my great-grandfather, Patrick Mason.
Yes.
Mary Connors was born in 1833, and her husband was born, Michael Durick, in 1829.
Yes.
So, sorry, that wasn't quite correct. But anyhow, Mary Mason, who was a daughter of Mary Connors from Ogunnellough, immigrated at the age of 16 to Australia.
Yeah.
In the year 1875.
Do we know whether she went alone or that other members?
Not to my knowledge that there was any other members, but naturally all the Jurics had been in Australia at this time.
And those are the Jurics from Maharik.
Maharik, yes, from Maharik. So she married, that Mary Mason married married Thomas Jurick.
What was Thomas doing out at the time?
Thomas was, all of the Jurics were entrepreneurs and big, we'll call it business people for the want of it.
They were hugely successful.
Hugely successful in every field, in gold and in farming and in writing, and they had many, many successes. But as you asked me, John, Thomas Jurick was in the hotel business, and he had a hotel. He was a very young man at this stage, and he had a hotel in Sydney in Australia. And believe it or not, a lot of the places the Jurics started up, they called them after local names of this area.
They did indeed, because I was looking at a map where the Scariff River appears in northwest Australia.
And so do two other rivers appear there, like Bow River.
Bow River, yes.
And Jurick River.
They all,
because they, and they named many places after Midline and Maharik and Bow River and all of those places.
Have you any figures for the amount of land which the Jurics?
The Jurics at one stage had land about the size of Ireland, which was a huge amount of land, naturally.
Yes.
And at one stage they had 22,000 sheep. That was after they moved to Cooper's Hill. And they had 4,000 cattle and 400 horses and so on. They were drovers and they were
buyers and sellers.
And
they
all
moved
that.
Up, didn't they, to the Darwin area of northern Australia.
Yeah. But when they were in Cooper's, they had a lot of sheep, as I just said, and they made garments out of sheep, and one of them presented a garment to His Holiness the Pope at that time, which was a big honour for them.
Yes.
So, go ahead. You
know, there was a book I remember written by Dame Mary Jurick.
Sure, yes.
Kings in Grass Castles.
Yes.
And a film was made from it, a series. Mm. And it showed the, I suppose, as you were describing there, how big they got in terms of business and politics as well.
You might question us how they got the name for this book. And the reason they got the name, or the reason Dame Mary Jurick got the name, was they were known as kings in the countryside.
Yes.
And they lived in grass houses at that stage, because Dame Mary Jurick, she lived with the Aborigines for a while to learn the skills of how to survive in the outback and all of that.
An extraordinary kind of awareness.
And for years later, you know, when the Aborigines were, you know, being hounded and so on, she stood up for them, she made a case for them, and she was loyal to them all her life.
Yes.
Now, I remember reading somewhere, Martin, about the
while you're thinking of that,
John,
you know, I'm just thinking that, you know, often we've all heard of the Jurics, but I don't think most of us realise how influential they were, how important they were in the life of Australia, and, you know, how you mentioned the word entrepreneur at the beginning there, and they were hugely entrepreneurial.
Sure, yes.
Yeah. The money. Yeah, that what I was about to refer to was the money that was being made beyond in Australia.
Mm.
Okay, some of that money was sent back to different members of the family to bring them out.
It would be tradition, I think, for most people going to Australia and America and all of those.
Now, I mean, why? I often wondered about the reason why we had the connection with Australia. I mean, my people who went abroad went to America and to Argentina. But the connection between East Clare and Australia is fierce strong, isn't it, really? Sure.
Yeah, well, you see, the first of the Durecks went to Australia back in the early 18, maybe 20 or thereabouts.
Yes, yes.
So the Durecks were, I won't say well established, but that was the connection in order for local people to go to Australia. And as you mentioned, Moneyjohn, in this letter that I have here written, signed by Mary Durek, who was Mary Mason.
Yes.
In the letter, she is talking about her eldest son, and he comes to visit her every day for dinner, and he's working in the local bank, earning £12 a week. Mm. Now, when you ask how did they send money back home out of their wages, well, her uncle, her brother was working at home, my grandfather, Michael Mason, and he built a house beside me for the Maroneys, as you just turn up the Forestry Road.
At the corner house.
Yeah. He built that house, a two-story house, a straight two-story house, not an L shape or any other shape.
Yeah.
And it possibly, because he was farming and cutting turf and sowing crops and things, maybe took him a year and a half to build this two-story house, stairs, windows, doors, everything, a roof. And he charged £7 tin shillings to build the house, which maybe took him a year and a half to 2 years, and the workman got £1 tin shillings. Now, his nephew was working in the bank in Australia at this time, earning £12 a week, according to this letter, dated 1924, and signed by his mother. There are five pages in the letter telling all about the family and the hotel, the Newmarket Hotel in Sydney, which is a preserved building now.
Newmarket Hotel.
Sydney.
On Sydney Street.
On Elizabeth Street.
Do you know what's interesting as well is that in my own notes I have a reference to O'Halloran's going to Australia and bringing back or sending back money to roof the house. It was a one-story thatch cottage, but ultimately it became a two-story. Okay.
Yes.
And it's referred to during the Baddack evictions that the money was Australian money, not American money. So here was Bodike, also linking in. You're not related to the O'Halloran.
No, I'm not. No, but it would have been tradition for most families to send. We have it engraved on our headstone in Minoa, where this Mary Mason and her sisters and brother that went to Australia, she left at 16. And when she had a little bit of money, she sent it back and the others followed out.
Yes.
And they worked in the hotel as well with her.
Yeah.
But they send the money back for the headstone, for the Mason headstone in the old graveyard in Minoa. And it's Spanish marble. Mm. And it's engraved on it, subscribed by the Masons in Australia.
Yes.
Very good. So what's amazing, just what strikes me, is this, the woman that Mary Mason that left Sheehan was your grand-aunt.
It was my grand-aunt, yes.
Yes. Mm. So, and she married Durek.
She married Durek.
And one of her children then was Fanny Durek.
Correct. So
now we're on
and into the meat of the sandwich at this
yes.
stage.
Yeah. We're talking about quite, Jim, quite an extraordinary situation.
Yes.
It was so extraordinary that it doesn't get referred to often.
It doesn't really, no. Okay.
And that is the interest which this young girl, Fanny, had in swimming. And women found it extremely difficult to get recognition in Australia. Indeed, in Ireland, there was opposition to girls participating in the 1930s, okay? participating in outdoor activities like swimming, because if you look at the photograph which I have here, Jim, 1912, this is the Fanny Jurek we're talking about.
Yes.
A fine cut of a girl, 1912. I wouldn't have thought that the dress code for swimming of that sort would have been permitted in Ireland.
Yeah, probably not.
100 years later. Yeah.
But I think, Martin, in various sports, and for a long time, women taking part was frowned upon.
Oh, sure. In Australia at that time, ladies swimming in swimsuits or whatever, in where there were men present, they would be prosecuted, they would be fined. You know, there was a terrible, terrible stigma attached to, and even the women in Australia also stood up for the men with regard to women bathing in public or swimming in public and so on. So just briefly to say that it was extraordinary when Fanny Jurek's mother got married at the age of 21 and her husband was only 23. It would have been normal in Australia at those times for women with a lot of skills going to Australia, like stitching and crochet and all of those knitting, would marry somebody that was much, much older than them. So they got married in 1880 and they had 9 children, of which Fanny Jurek was the middle one of them.
My grandmother, Martin, my grandmother was married at the age of 16 to my grandfather, who was 46. Which fits into the pattern you were talking about.
Because in Australia in those times, you know, the husband was dead before the children were very well, before they were finished college or finished reading and so on.
Yeah.
Did they live in the Sydney area?
They lived in the hotel.
In Sydney.
In Sydney. In the hotel in Sydney. There's where my grandaunt lived all her life, and I have it there in another letter when she sold the hotel and she moved into a 9-bedroomed house.
Yes.
I mean, the money they're talking about then would buy all of Sheehan and Capabad.
Yes,
and
of course.
And Mahariq nowadays.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so.
But she must have, if she lived in Sydney, she obviously had access to water, to the sea, and she obviously was interested in swimming.
She had a very good friend in Mina Wiley.
That is extraordinary, the Wiley name, figuring.
Yeah. And were they from here as well?
I have no idea, Jim, now where they were from and that, but Mina Wiley.
But they're Wileys, they're still Wileys.
Oh, they're still Wileys, sure.
I have a small little piece here written by Helen King about Fanny, 1889 to 1956, that's the era you're talking about. Mm. She was born on the 27th of October, 1889, at Elizabeth Street, Sydney, third daughter and sixth child of Irish parents Thomas Jurek, publican, a relation of Patrick Jurek and his wife Mary, née Mason. Although women had been forbidden by the New South Wales Ladies Amateur Swimming Association, they were forbidden to appear in competition where men were present. Such were her successes as a swimmer, however, that there was public demand for her to go to the 1912 Stockholm Olympics. But she had a fierce struggle, but it had a profound effect, long term, hadn't it?
Sure had, yes.
Because she got to, force of public opinion, she got to represent Australia. Jim, she was knocking world records. Left, right, and she won the gold medal, of course, for the 100 metres.
But not alone that, John. There was so much awareness with that, with her sisters and all the other people that raised money and so on, that instead of being able to send Fanny Jurek to Stockholm to the Olympics in 1912, they were also able to send Mina Wiley to the Olympics as well. So it was a huge breakthrough.
She was a swimmer as well.
She was a swimmer as well. So that's perhaps how they got so good, as one was competing against the other.
Yes.
like Fanny Jurek, her first competition, her home competition in Australia, she was age 12, swimming in the under 15 category, and she won it easily. So she was very prominent, very powerful, and everybody was talking about her.
I was looking up this morning. In one of the heats, she broke the world record. 1 minute 19.8 seconds for the 100 metres. And she broke that again a couple of weeks later in Hamburg.
Oh, yes, yes.
And again, she broke it again a few years later in February of 1915.
But when she broke that world record, it was in the semi-final of the Olympic Games in heat 4.
Yes.
And it was pointing that she would break that world record the following day again in the final of the Olympics. But she was drawn in the lane by the wall, and she bumped off the wall halfway through, and the other swimmers passed her out until she got back on track, but she won the gold medal.
Yes.
And her friend Mina Wiley was second. She didn't break the record
in the final.
Yes. And she was the first Australian woman to win a gold medal for Australia. And only one other woman up to the year 56, one other Australian woman had won a gold medal for Australia. So up to 1956, that was the year that Fanny Jurek died.
Yes.
Up to that year, there were only two women from Australia that had won gold medals in the Olympics.
But they subsequently dominated in the Olympics, didn't they?
Dominated in the world.
In the world.
Of course, 1956, the Olympics were back in Australia.
Yes.
In Melbourne.
Yes.
The year Ronnie Delaney won the gold medal for Ireland.
Mm. Were you conscious as a young man of this extraordinary cousin you had?
Well, I was only 5 years old when Fanny passed away, but I remember it extremely well. There was terrible sadness in Xi'an when the news came through, and I presume it came through by letter or by some other way, that Fanny Jurek had passed away.
Yeah.
And it was like maybe, when John F. Kennedy got shot and so on, it was terrible news.
Yes.
And Fanny Jurek was equivalent to that. Now, Fanny Jurek never got to return to her mother's hometown of Xi'an, Scariff, Maharee, Coconello. But in the 30s, in the 1930s, she was on her way to this area with her sister, and they were in London when her sister got sick, and they were advised to return to Australia.
Yes.
You can imagine the celebration at the pier in Mount Shannon.
Yes.
At the 2 mile gate, when one of their daughters was swimming there.
Yeah.
Yes.
With the excitement in the spectators, the excitement in young and old, and that might be swimming with her in Lough Derg or in the 2 mile gate or whatever.
It must have caused enormous excitement and celebrations, we'll say, in your family. I mean, for your dad, and I remember him well, I mean, he would be a young man at that stage.
Yes.
His first cousin winning Olympic gold medal.
Sure, yes.
I mean, that must have been...
Well, my father never got too excited about...
about anything?
Well, he did, but not about relations.
Yes.
And not about gossip or spicy gossip or anything like that. My father was more into engineering, we'll call it, like he had his own hydroelectrical generation station back in the 30s.
Yes. Could we actually focus on that for a minute, Martin?
Yeah, okay.
I was aware your father was, and your grandfather.
Yes, yes.
They had a technological bent to it, do you know?
Yes.
Where did that come from?
Well,
you have examples of...
Well, briefly, you know, we're focusing mainly here on Fanny Jurek and her success, but at that time in 1912, 2 years before that, my grandfather was aware that Halley's Comet was coming around.
Yes.
And he made his own telescope in order to view and stayed up at night and so on. And he knew Halley's Comet was coming within a number of days. Nowadays, it's coming, they know, to the second. And himself and a Dublin Sperling, who had come back from college in England, was also very interested in this. Now, he was a...
But your dad hadn't been to college in England or in Ireland.
No, he hadn't been to college anywhere.
That's what makes it fascinating.
But he had a good pair of hands, obviously.
Yeah. Well, he knew Pythagoras' theorem inside out without ever studying it.
Yeah.
So he and my aunt Mara O'Looney up in Lahinch that had a hotel that was a teacher in Capybara School and left it to start up a, what I call a dry hotel, like the Torment Hotel. There was no public bar or swimming pool or leisure centre or anything like that. So herself and my uncle Patrick Mason, who worked on the railway, they got up at night with their father to go view the Halley's Comet, and they went up to the top of the road, which would have made maybe a little difference to the distance between Halley's Comet and Sheehan.
Yeah.
So that was...
How was that? Because you do have some, direct recollection, but you do remember Halley's Comet story talked about in the Mason...
Oh, sure, yeah, because it appeared again, Halley's Comet, in, I think it was 1968 was the next time it appeared in the sky. But at that time in 1910, when my father went to Mass and that, everybody was shunning him. They weren't, they were falling out with him. They thought he was communicating with the devil.
Are you serious?
And it was in the prophecy that the world would be destroyed by fire and destroyed by water at another stage, and so... After a while, you know, that went by the wayside.
I remember you telling me once as well that in the Mass Rock in Capybara, was it your grandfather or your father?
My grandfather.
He carved the chalice on the front of the Mass Rock.
He did indeed, and it's a striking piece there all the time.
Yes.
100 years later, so we're talking about around that time as well.
Yeah, I know Peggy always had it painted silver.
I'd say... one of the last people to paint it would have been my late wife, Kathleen Mason Ní Cóiri.
Yes.
And he also put the cross.
The Iron Cross.
The Iron Cross, which was made in a forge at the back of J.J. Butler's, not Kevin Byrne's forge, which would have been down at the ambulance centre. And that forge is made out of iron, and it is there for 100 years with practically no rust on it, no galvanizing, no painting, no nothing. So the iron that they used then, they knew that it would withstand the test of time. And the Mass Rock in Capybara, of course, has many features on it, like the confessional box and the Holy Communion rail and so on.
Yes.
So that, and then my father would have invented a lot of things as well. So, and my brother Michael would have been an engineer as well, able to wire houses and everything.
But this is then self-taught.
Self-taught, yes, yes.
Yeah.
So we're skipping away a little bit from the great Fanny Jurek.
Yes.
So
let's skip back in.
Skip back in again. Now, it wasn't all rosy in the Jurek family in Sydney, Australia.
No.
When this letter was written in 1924, she had buried a son and a daughter. So she had three sons and a daughter buried, you know, before they were 45 years of age.
Yeah.
Yes. So in 1919, which is only just before the Olympics, of that she buried a daughter and her husband. Her husband died in 19, age 62. Mm. So he was a relatively young man, but all the four children, sure, were only, you know, under from 45 down to 31.
Yes.
So that was half her family buried and her husband in a few short years. So it wasn't all celebrating Olympics.
Yes.
But did you hear conversations at home about the Australian connection? Was it something that was talked about? Was it something that was talked about?
Oh, it was talked about an awful lot, John, particularly with my aunt Mara O'Looney and two other aunts as well. They talked an awful lot about it. And my aunt Mara O'Looney wrote, you know, only 2 years before she passed away, she wrote about the Jureks in Australia and the Mason connection and all of that. So there was a a lot of talk, and particularly with my mother, because we had Australian visitors come and visit us back the years. And one of their, a grandson of this woman was the first flying doctor in Australia. So they were, there were business people and educated people, and they knew how to survive in the outback, which was just amazing.
I was just thinking, looking at her records, obviously she was reaching a peak in the mid-teens, we'll say 19, 14, 15, 16, and improving all the time. Of course, there was no Olympic Games in 1916 because of the war.
The war. But she was 21 when she won the gold medal in Stockholm. So she was very young, like some of the youngsters that you see swimming now, in the Olympics are very young.
They're only teenagers.
So by the time, as you say, Jim, the next Olympics was cancelled because of the war. And then the following Olympics, which would have been possibly her last Olympics, showing up on 30 years of age, she got an appendix problem. A couple of days before the Olympics, so that ruled her out of that.
Okay, and that would have been Antwerp, I think.
Antwerp.
The Olympics in 1920.
And then, I suppose, if we move on to some of the recognitions that she got, like in 1994, there was a $10 Australian coin commissioned. And I have it here with me, the $10 coin. And it is a $10 coin, and it is made of almost pure silver, and it weighs 20.77 grams, 34.1 millimetres in diameter, and the minting year was 94. And on the one side is Queen Elizabeth II, and on the other side is Sarah Jurick, better known as Fanny Jurick, the great Australian swimmer. So it says with the note that this coin has been struck in the purest silver with a very low worldwide edition limited in celebration of the achievements of Sarah Jurick, properly known as Fanny. Her career competing in distances of 100 metres to a mile. Her success is considered quite remarkable. In the 1912 Olympics, she won her first heat in a time equal to the men's. She went on to win every event to become Australia's first female gold swimmer.
Yes.
And she held, I think, is it 12 world records in her time. And she swam anything from, a sprint to a mile. So she covered every distance. I believe my father would have often talked about her and that she had big hands. Mm. And I'm sure they were a huge asset.
Yes, to scoop the water back.
To shovel it back.
Yes. As you reflected on this program coming up, how do you feel inside in you? How do you feel about Fanny?
I suppose I would have loved to have visited Australia. And I think I sure would if my late wife Kathleen was still alive.
Mm.
So to visit Australia would bring back many, many, many memories to me, and particularly Sydney and Elizabeth Street.
Yeah.
And
the
Newmarket Hotel.
Newmarket, they christened it the Newmarket.
Sure, yes. Because as you mentioned already, we had Bow River and...
Did you mention earlier that's still standing and is a preserved building?
Preserved building.
Yes.
Newmarket Hotel in Sydney, in Elizabeth Street. It's a preserved building.
Do we know much, Martin, about her later life post-swimming? Did she get married? Did she have children?
She got married to a very wealthy man. And now maybe she was wealthy herself, but she married a very wealthy man by the name of Barney Gately.
Yes.
And they had no family. But he was a horse trainer and big into horses and running and all that, I would presume, in the Melbourne Cup and all of these big events.
Yes. Yes.
So he died before her. So they had no family, but there is many swimming pools in Australia named after Fanny Jurek.
Yes.
And she's in the Hall of Fame as well.
Yes.
In 1967, she was induced into the Hall of Fame, which is especially for swimmers and people who contributed to swimming and coaches maybe and so on. So she...
But apart from her swimming prowess, which obviously was, she was the best in the world for a number of years, but she broke the mold as well.
She did.
In terms of women's sports, because that's probably extends far beyond swimming. You know, she could, that women were, it was accepted that women would take part.
Well, as many people, like, we'll call it retired hurlers in Scariff, she dedicated her life to teaching and training young swimmers.
Yes.
She spent a lot of her time teaching and training and coaching and upskilling young swimmers.
Yes.
I presume male and female, maybe.
For and of course, Australia is renowned as a swimming country.
Sure, yes,
and
yes.
With loads of Olympic and world records down the years.
Mm-hmm. But originally, there was only men selected on the Australian team.
I know.
So for her to get through, and her great friend, Mina Wiley, but that it was very, very difficult for women in those days, and sure, we know in our own lifetime how difficult it
how difficult
was.
It is.
1930, early 30s, Archbishop McQuaid had some difficulties with regard to girls participating in athletics. It was a strange world.
Strange world, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm just thinking it would be, it's a fantastic thing for your family, first of all, you know, and I mean for the area as well, even though it mightn't be as well known. Hopefully this will raise people's awareness of it. You know, that I mean, we haven't had many people who left here and produced Olympic gold medalists.
Sure, yes.
You know, so I mean, that is a brilliant achievement.
And he has talking to him to Martin yesterday, he has ideas in relation to the medal, that silver medal, suitably presented, and that he would love to give it to the library, and we work on that.
Yes.
I also have a photograph here of the house where Fanny Jurek's mother was born. It was taken in 1917, which was just a few years after Fanny had won her gold medal. And it is another example of my grandfather, you know, making a telescope.
That
it's a thatched roof, and there is a window in the thatched roof, of which would be very, very rare in those times.
Like a Velux window.
Like a Velux window, yes.
Yeah.
And because there was an upstairs in this house.
Yes.
And maybe the upstairs was known as a loft or something. So in order to get light in, this window was ideal. Yes. At least, you know, when the dawn was breaking.
Yes, in a thatched house, that would demand great skill for thatching and for roofing and all that. Is that house, are any remains of it still there?
No remains of it, sadly.
Yes.
And remains of the hydroelectric generation station is covered over. My brother Michael would have bulldozed it out of the way with machinery.
I know, yes.
It was irrelevant. The only one that I know that speaks about that electrical generation is Paddy Joe McMahon from Capaban.
He would have heard of it and seen it.
He would have seen it. He would have seen it. And
Because we'll have to talk. To Paddy Joe.
We've had him before.
We didn't know this, though.
No.
Well, his 90th birthday is coming up now later in the year, so that might be an occasion to bring him in, along with the other.
Indeed.
Two that were 90, Neil Aslong and Vinnie Hinchy, this year as well. So.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, Martin. I suppose it's a pleasure to have you in, and it's fantastic to hear about Fanny Jurek and her connection, Mary Mason from Sheehan. It is, I mean, to be honest, I wasn't aware of it at all.
No.
Do you know? And I mean, I would imagine a lot of other people wouldn't have been either.
Yeah.
Well, so. Xi'an is a very, very small place and a dot in the map, but we can't leave out Maharik and Ogunilo and Mount Shannon and the whole area would be very closely knit.
It would, of course, yeah, because it's just across the valley from you can see one place from the other.
The little rivers that distinguish between Maharik and Zaraf, Mount Shannon, Bow River and so on. Yeah. And it's funny, then my grandfather's wife, who was Catherine Bleach, she was the first student enrolled in Capaban School when it opened.
Yes.
Many, many moons ago, and it's closed for a lot of moons now as well, so she would have been the first. And my Aunt Mara O'Looney, who was a teacher in Capaban School, she was a student at the in June, and she was a teacher in September. And the other teacher in the school was an aunt of Tom McNamara and my Noah House.
And the Dolman.
And the Torment, so she would have been an aunt of, she'd be a sister of Michael Max, Tom's father. And she...
But she was a student, the girl you talk about was a student up to June.
Yes.
And a teacher from September.
Teacher from September.
Yeah.
And she taught, the McNamara woman gave the senior class in the evenings to my aunt.
Yes.
Because my aunt was able to do crochet and short stitching and all of that.
Yes.
And she used to cycle into Limerick, into Woolworths, to get the
raw materials.
Get the raw material in order to do all of this.
Yeah.
So he has an extraordinary recollection.
Extraordinary. I mean, you talk about deep roots in a place.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very deep.
And funny enough, my first cousin. From Roscommon, Trish Boone married one of the Juleks.
Yes.
Okay.
So there's a strange connection, isn't there?
So the other small thing that I'll mention while I'm here is that about 25 years ago I found butter in the bog. And the butter was 400 years old. And I honestly believe it was as good the day I found it 400 years later as it was when it was put in the bog to preserve it.
Yes. Give us a little picture, a micro picture.
The micro picture is that, as we all know, plastic wasn't around in those days like it is now. It's everywhere. And the plastic bag they used at that time for the butter was the stomach of an animal. So in the summertime, an animal would be fat. And it would be killed for meat for the house for the year. And the couple of cows would have extra milk and they'd have extra cream. They had a separator and a churn and make the butter and put it in the bog because there was no electricity, no fridge, no freezer. And the bog would preserve it for thousands of years, I would say.
Yes.
But when I found it, a little chip had broken off the end of it. And a cousin of mine from Australia was around 25 years ago and she took that little chip with her and the rest of the butter is in the museum in Dublin.
Yeah.
So I don't know what she did with that little piece
yes.
or whether it survived, as we all know, butter. The reason the butter was put in the bog was to preserve it, so if it's out of the bog for any period, I presume...
It would be in a freezer or something.
It would deteriorate pretty quick on a journey to Australia.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, I think we have another guest outside, so we'll finish up. Martin, again, many thanks for joining us. It's a fascinating story, and hopefully that our listeners will have enjoyed it throughout East Clare, and maybe further afield as well.
Well,
okay. And we'll follow up, Martin, on the library connection.
Yes, sure.
And the medal.
Yes, I think that it's not much good at home, maybe, in many ways, in my filing cabinet.
Indeed.
Because in years to come, like it might be, you know, of interest to other people and young people coming from Australia or going to Australia and whatever else.
Okay.